Welcome to another exciting episode of the NIDS View, a weekly show of the National Institute for Deterrence Studies, where we are advancing peace, promoting stability, and helping you to think deterrence. Each week, we discuss and analyze a recent topic and provide insight into how it affects our national deterrence. We hope you enjoy this show.
Welcome back to another great episode of the NIDS View, which is, of course, a podcast of the National Institute for Deterrence Studies. Now, today, Curtis and I, Jim is on vacation, so it's Curtis and I, and we're, you know, recording this podcast shortly after the election of Donald Trump to the White House to be the 47th president of the United States. And of course, we thought, you know, it would be a good topic to discuss what nuclear policy might look like in the Trump administration. So that's what we thought we'd do. It seems to be a great time for such a topic. And with, you know, Trump returning to the White House, we also have the added benefit of him already having served one term as president. So we kind of know what he thinks and at least what he wanted to do. Now, things have changed since the 2018 NPR, but that, you know, serves as sort of a waypoint for us to understand what he might do in this next administration. Curtis, of course, good to see you.
Good to see you, Adam.
I know this is a topic you were excited to talk about. So why don't you kick us off? And, you know, I'm sort of curious. I'm sure, you know, the listeners are, you know, they have their own ideas. So, of course, if you can always email us or send us a message. But to me, it seems with the 2018 NPR in hand, the world's gotten more dangerous. And in that 2018 NPR, you know, we got the low yield variant of the Trident D5. There was the development of the sea launch cruise missile, slick them in. And then who knows what we might get in the years ahead. We might get the, you know, uploading of warheads onto the Minuteman III. Who knows what's in store in the future? How do you see things potentially falling out?
Well, thanks, Adam. You know, I think one of the big things here is we're going to see this return to realism, the perspective, this realist perspective of how America will see the world as it did in the 2017 National Security Strategy, 2018 Nuclear Posture Review and Nuclear Defense Strategy. You know, let me digress for a moment here. Adam, I don't know if you've heard, but there's rumors going around that the new Trump administration might not bother with a new NPR, that it might not be useful anymore, that it consumes a lot of administrative time and so forth, and that it's not necessary. And some very poignant thinkers have mentioned that, not only just to me, but to other folks, I think, out there. And I would say this, I hope that's not the case. I really hope, at the very least, the new administration takes the 2018 NPR, sort of blows the dust off of it, and updates it, right, to what the world is now, and then puts that back out, because I think it's very important for the primary audiences of an NPR to know what is expected of the nuclear enterprise in this sea change election, so to speak. And so, you know, because again, you know, Adam, you know, who's the audience for the NPR, right? It's probably not the American people, because they really don't read these sorts of documents. They're kind of wonky and so forth. But I'll tell you who is the primary, at least as I see it, and that is allies, adversaries, and of course, Congress. Yeah. And to some extent, the DOD itself. And you could throw in the DOE because of the nukes. And so, and those folks need to have those marching orders. These documents, like the NPR, become source documents for requirements identification, which feeds into the acquisition process and these sorts of things. So that when, you know, some some general officer out there says, why do we need that in the budget? You can point to a source document like the new, like the 2025 NPR and say, well, it says right here, sir, we're supposed to have this.
Yeah.
And so I think that's a very useful purpose of these kinds of documents, because the bureaucracy itself will be slow to turn unless you have documents that call for it. And then going forward, our allies and adversaries read these documents because they actually believe them as American policy, probably more so than Americans themselves. Because, you know, we launch these things and the world turns and we meander away from these sorts of documents, and that can become confusing. But at least at the beginning, when the chalk line is snapped after, within the first few months of inauguration, allies and adversaries at least need to have a basic idea of where President Trump's peace through strength initiative is going to be. And my last sort of environmental assessment here is when we think about what is likely to be the new 2.0 America First strategy, we need the world and America to understand that America First does not mean America alone. And I hope we talk more about this today, Adam, because I think it's important to understand that I believe the next administration is going to continue to nurture alliances, not run from them. So I'll stop there. What are your thoughts?
Yeah, I mean, you bring up alliances, and it seems to me very clear that President-elect Trump, soon to be President Trump, as of what, January 20th, mm-hmm. will be more open to the nuclear participation of allies like South Korea and Japan. I don't think, you know, he's long said allies need to cover the cost of their own defense more. Mm-hmm. And what's interesting is this week, maybe a day or two ago, I was reading a recent survey from Europe, from NATO member countries, and overwhelmingly they supported the United States defending Europe, but they were not as supportive. They were far less supportive of them defending themselves. It was a public opinion survey.
Yeah.
And I was like, wait a second. So you're happy for us to defend you? And you want us, the Americans, defending you more than you want to defend yourself? And so I, read that and was just thought, it sort of made, President Trump's point. But if you go to Asia, for example, because Europe's a very different situation than Asia in the sense that they have some, economic and, if you look at their populations and you look at the internal dynamics of NATO member states, they're in a much more challenging position than, say, Korea and Japan, although they have some of the same demographic challenges. But South Korea and Japan seem to be more willing to build, first-rate militaries that can defend themselves. And South Korea has been, itching to build their own capabilities as long as their economy is not crushed by the United States for doing so. And so we now have an opportunity where we might have the guy in the White House who says, okay, I'll go along with that. And like you said, I could see, because I'm sure many of our listeners already know, maybe some don't, but when you do a nuclear posture review, you've got people, it's going to include NNSA, DOE, Department of Defense, and Department of the Air Force, the Navy, the White House, State Department. It's going to include people in throughout, Air Force A-10, Global Strike Command. You're going to have people everywhere, and they're going to spend at least a year. It probably, if we were to cost out man hours and all of that, it costs millions of dollars, and it takes a lot of time from the very people who work nuclear issues, STRATCOM, and they're all going to be focused on this. So if there's a more expedient way to get some policy out while doing the things that are not publicly visible, which this is the discussion, hey, let's not focus our time and resources, which are limited. let's not focus it on an NPR. Let's just go change the guidance that actually is what, you know, makes forces operate. And, you know, if we're going to, you know, upload, if we're going to change how we operate, or for whatever we're going to do, just go do that. And so there's, you know, your argument and their argument both have, you know, utility. But we'll have to just wait and see what they do, because I, you know, I'm not really quite sure what, you know, what it is that we're going to, you know, ultimately do. But I do know we're going to do something different, right? We're not going to make the same mistake as, you know, the Biden administration, which their, you know, their nuclear posture review, we're going to get rid of the hedge. We're going to do all of these things. We're integrated deterrence. Oh, that's another thing. We get to be the ones to celebrate the death of integrated deterrence. It's right here, folks, on, you know, the NIDS view. Integrated deterrence is now dead, which I have long thought it was a terrible, you know, terrible approach to deterrence. But it was one that when you wanted to minimize nuclear weapons, that's what you chose. And it's, you know, the Ukraine is a perfect example of where it didn't work. And so, you know, we'll see something much different.
Well, I would argue that it's not working in the Pacific either. You and I will agree to disagree, I guess, on the value of the NPR. But I think it is key that the new president has to get his policies dictated downward. I know there are other documents, often more classified and hidden from the public, of which he can pursue more guidance. But I would argue that there needs to be unclassified guidance.
No, so I got you. I'm not disagreeing with you. We just can't spend the kind of time and resources that we normally spend.
Well, I think if we're doing a track change on the old 2018, it won't take that long. So, so let's get the right people on it. We could do it in a month, if President Trump's happy with it, or even as still as an elect, he can approve it, and it just becomes public, you know, on inauguration day. So there's a number of ways to do that. Let me add to your comment on what I like to refer to as allied empowerment. So we have long advocated for nuclear participation by responsible first world allies who have the desire, the capability, and the economy to support perhaps becoming a nuclear power. And that I think part of the change that needs to occur is sort of this taboo of proliferating amongst allies and friends. You know, I always go back to the old Scoop Jackson Democrat hawk of the 1970s Cold War nuclear deterrent, you know, who basically said that it's the preponderance of power needs to be with the good guys. And not the bad guys. I'm paraphrasing, of course, and that's why it mattered. And what we're seeing is you know, sort of the bad guys sort of building up, if you will, and the good guys aren't, or not as much. And so we need to we probably need to get in that game, and I think we'll see some of that. And so with regard to this, the allied support, I don't know if you know this, Adam, because we didn't talk about it in a previous podcast, because I missed this. But back in March of this year, the president of Poland, President Duda of Poland, asked the Biden administration to work with him to support pushing, changing the 2% minimum at NATO to a 3% minimum at NATO.
And
the Biden administration pushed back on that. It was reported back in March that they thought that was too much of an ask. And I find that fascinating in the middle. March of 2024. I mean, we're in year two of the war in Ukraine, and America is telling its allies, 3% might be too much. And there was some speculation that that the ultimate goal of a Harris administration was they want to get the defense budget below 3%, so they didn't want to see a NATO requirement to be at 3%, because that would have had a problem with their budgetary goals for DOD. So the election may have reversed that mindset. And with regard to Korea, you know, we know that their folks have consistently polled 70% in support of having organic nuclear capabilities within South Korea, either, well, organic, either self-produced or having American weapons back on the peninsula. And the President Yoon actually said, I'm not going to do this because I can't subject the Korean economy to the kinds of sanctions that the West would put on them for proliferating. He was more afraid of his allies than he was of his adversaries at that point.
Yeah.
Now that might change, to your point. And I think America has to, regardless of who was going to be president, has to really wrestle with this idea that if the goal is for allies to pay more, and by the way, that was a complaint in the Obama administration. It was a complaint in the Trump administration. It was a complaint in the Biden administration. So this is a bipartisan issue. It was President Obama who first sort of coined the phrase free riders, right? We don't want these free riders. I think if we're not going to ask allies to pay more for their own defense, right, then I think it's a realistic question as to why should we be more invested in their own defense than they are. Did you know that Taiwan's defense budget for 2025 is forecasted to be less than 3% of their GDP?
Yeah.
And they're at risk of being invaded.
I know. I
just don't understand it.
It is one where it's a bit shocking, really. I mean, it's like if we're contemplating and planning for a war with China that could potentially go nuclear, Taiwan, why are you not doing what it takes to defend yourself? It boggles the mind, because if you don't care about your own security, why should we? And that's, you know, it's a reasonable question for any American ally. And maybe, you know, it's like, you know, the accusation for Europe is that, hey, well, we know the Americans will come. And so maybe that's, you know, you could question, is this a perception? I haven't talked to the Taiwanese, so I don't know. I mean, it could be wrong. Perhaps the Taiwanese feel that the Americans will come. And therefore, you know, they feel free to focus on their economic growth and development. But, you know, that's one I can't say. But it is one where, you know, we do have – things are changing, right? We already know people are – you know, you've got the LA Times that they're going to reshuffle to be more balanced. You've got all sorts of things that are changing in terms of what's going to happen. But nuclear policy, we know we'll get slick them in. We know it'll be funded. You know, that's a pretty solid, you know, pretty solid guess. We probably can say that the nuclear arsenal will grow, that size, you know, that the operationally deployed number of strategic nuclear weapons will probably grow. We'll probably put a new start in the ground. You know, we've been in a treaty with ourselves. We'll probably That's right. bury that treaty. It's gone. That's one thing we can say. But, you know, you do have some appointees. So, for example, Tulsi Gabbard, who's going to be the DNI, when she was in Congress, supported no first use and wanted an official no first use policy. So, you know, President Trump is sort of a, you know, he can be a wild card. I mean, picking Matt Gaetz for his nominee for attorney general is, you know, that's sort of a wild card pick. The choice of Pete Hegseth for Secretary of Defense, that was one that people weren't expecting. There were some sort of folks that have been around a lot longer that were expected in these positions. So there are parts of the policy of the president that we may or may not be able to anticipate because of, you know, who's coming into the administration. But, you know, I think this is a point you make over and over, Curtis, and that is, if you want less war, then build your nuclear forces. Because your nuclear forces are not designed to fight wars in Iraq and Afghanistan and Syria. And, you know, you pick places. That's not what they're for. Mm-hmm. They guarantee the sovereignty of the nation. And so if you want less war, buy less stuff that's useful in places like Iraq and Afghanistan or in elsewhere, and buy more nukes.
Well, I, looking back at the list you just gave, I'm not going to kind of go where, you know, I'm not going to kind of say, you know, whether they're good picks or bad picks or whatever. To me, they are different picks. And I think what's interesting is the perturbation of business as usual. I think what is interesting about these picks per se.
That's,
I think
we that can day is over.
Yeah, I think what we can look forward to now is within the DOD a reprioritization away from climate change and back to preventing war as one of the number one goals. And so this is where I think President-elect, soon to be President Trump's pursuance of peace through strength is defined as in that. And I'd also like to see the elimination of this term to discuss China as quote unquote the pacing threat. I think that term needs to be replaced with something like a formidable adversary, militarily and economically, or something along these lines. They have become a juggernaut that we can no longer sort of dismiss with kind, or I should say misleading terms like pacing threat, or the way we have described Russia as an acute threat. Russia is a persistent threat that is never going to go away as long as that nuclear arsenal exists. And leaders within the Kremlin are interested in revisionist policies. And so we're going to have to, we need to, that's the essence of realism, right? And that's where I think when I said that we're going to see the world again through a realist lens, realism is about a balance of power, right? And so I think we're going to have to deal with these adversaries and acknowledge them. And I think the one thing I have to say, Adam, and I'm interested in your thoughts on this, trying to remain as apolitical here as I can, but looking at the Trump administration, the first Trump administration, and what we might expect in the second Trump administration versus what we saw previously in the Obama administration and then the Biden-Harris administration, is that we must figure out a way to decouple our economy from our adversary. We must stop trading and thus funding our adversaries' capabilities and economies and these sorts of things. We have to figure out a way to do that. Even Janet Yellen, the Treasury Secretary, you know, recently stated in her tenure that decoupling from China is neither desired nor practical. And I think it's because it's not a priority. Everything's doable if you make it a priority. And I think bringing those kinds of jobs and capabilities back here to America is incredibly important. You know, there's a lot of things we don't make here anymore. I mean, Adam, do you know that we don't even make penicillin in this country anymore? It's all made in China.
Yeah. I mean, China's the largest producer of medicines in the world. And by the way, they're also the largest producer of chemicals used to create fentanyl, which is something that you've talked about before.
I'm so glad you brought that up. The fentanyl crisis here is one of the things. And again, this goes back to China. And, you know, it's well documented. It's been reported from Congress people and government and non-government alike about the impact here. You know, we lose more Americans. More Americans are killed by Chinese funded and Mexican narco fentanyl. We lose more Americans per year than we have in all of the wars from Korea to present. I mean, think about that.
Yeah.
All the deaths of Americans through the Korean War, the Vietnam War, all the Cold War, the War on Terror, and everything in between, we lose more Americans per year than all of those combined.
Yeah.
It is amazing. We are under attack and we don't even, we either don't seem to care or don't realize it, but this is no longer just a law enforcement problem. This is a national security problem. And I think, I hope that the next administration is going to address it accordingly, dealing with the TCOs down in Mexico, as well as the pharmaceuticals that are coming, precursors and pill presses and these sorts of things that are coming across. We talk about weapons of mass destruction all the time, Adam, but when you look at how much fentanyl, the FBI Director Wray testified earlier this year to Congress that the FBI over the 2 years up to that point, so this probably would have been 23, 24, or late 22 to 24, that the FBI had seized enough fentanyl. That's what they seized, enough fentanyl to kill 270 million Americans. I mean, that's two-thirds of the country's population. That's more than the U.S. predicted in a massive laydown during the Cold War. Had that gone out, I mean, this is real trouble. There's some estimates out there that every year they produce enough fentanyl to kill 3 billion people a year, billion, and around the world. This is crazy, and something has to be done about it. So
yeah,
that will happen.
I tell you, one of the things that I wish we would have, and you know, maybe this is something President Trump will do, and that is we have to have a guns versus butter debate. That is something we have not had, because if you look, we've been borrowing, you know, even go back to the start of COVID, we've borrowed $2 trillion a year. Our debt payments are now more than the defense budget, and the defense budget is the lowest as a percentage of GDP. It's about 3.4%. We have historically averaged about 5% of spending on GDP. So it's been going down, and the, you know, social programs have been going up. And so most of your social programs are, you know, 80% of the budget, more than 80% of the budget. And so they can't continue to grow, and they're not even sustainable, because you can't borrow $2 trillion a year for this stuff. You just can't. Eventually, you go bankrupt. And so we're going to have a debate over, can we control, you know, this borrowing money to then transfer it, because everybody wants a handout. And therefore, can we cut that? And we don't have to necessarily replace it with defense spending, but we have to spend enough, you know, to keep, you know, the wolves at bay. And because they clearly see the Russians, the Chinese, the North Koreans, the Iranians, they want to topple the order that we have established around the world. They don't like it. China wants to be back. You know, they want a hierarchical international order where they're at the top. They think that's where they rightfully belong. And so we're going to have to do something about, you know, domestic spending. We have to handle that, because it's out of control. And, you know, we'll reach a point where we're very much like the Japanese, because the Japanese have largely had a stagnant economy. Listeners, if you're my age, you know, I'm 50. Curtis is, you know, he's a little younger than me.
I'm a little older than you.
but you guys remember in the 1980s, we had all these movies and all this concern that Japan was going to take down America because Japan's economy was going to surpass ours. But it was debt fueled. It was a debt fueled economy. And now we have a debt fueled economy. Mm-hmm. And so will we see stagnation like Japan has for more than two decades? And so we've got to be careful and address this, you know, whether it's rebuilding the nuclear enterprise, you know, whether it's stopping fentanyl, we have to address the guns versus butter issue.
Well, I would add to that, unfortunately, I think the Chinese economy is becoming more debt fueled as well.
It is.
And in addition to your other notes, you know, just since 2017, so at the start of the Trump administration before, and then through this COVID experience and then out of the COVID experience and then into the Biden administration's economic policies, we experienced over those 6 years, between 17 and 24, so I guess that's 7 years, 28.5% inflation. And that's pretty significant for that short amount of period. And most of that came, post 2021. It was about a 20% inflation rate from 2021 to 2024. And so when we think about the massive expansion of the costs of weapon systems, and budgets accordingly, because when the economy, when the cost to do business increases arbitrarily by 20%, that means organizations need money in order to do business, right? So budgets expand. And then budgets never decrease after that, right? So we might see some zero-based budgeting here under the new administration. We'll see. You know, we have the DOGE, right? This this Department of Government Efficiency that might be standing up here under Elon Musk and Vivek Ramaswamy and other folks. So I would say that perhaps there's some cost savings to be had. But the prediction that the cost to service the debt, to pay the interest to service the national debt, would not surpass the defense budget probably to the end of the decade. And it already has today. So it has gone crazily out of control. This is a big problem. This is a big problem. Servicing the debt is a big problem. So bringing interest rates down actually will help defense budgets and acquisitions and these sorts of things, make things a little cheaper. And we really need to incentivize moving some of this modernization to the left. I think one of the things that bugs me the most, Adam, is less about the cost and more about the time. It takes just way too long to build these things and bring things online. And the Chinese and the Russians are doing it much faster. The Chinese just got finished building 300 missile silos in the Gobi Desert in 2 years. I mean, we would still be doing the environmental impact statements and litigating it in the court system before we'd even started to turn, a shovel of dirt. And so we've got some bureaucracy issues that we have to solve as well. So perhaps the next presidency will solve those issues as well.
I wish I had an entire episode just to discuss how economics work and how they're tied in, because there's so much about this. I mean, our inflation rate isn't even close to what it should be. Remember, we have a fiat currency system, and so, you know, it's the value of the money is it's faith based. So for those who want religion out of government, then you got to get rid of our currency system. But because we're the currency of trade, we have not experienced the kind of inflation that, you know, Argentina or any other country that isn't us experiences. Because normally when you double the money supply, the value of money gets cut in half.
Right.
And we've more than that, because who do we borrow money from? We're not borrowing it from private, you know, from Americans buying bonds or from the Chinese. We're borrowing it from the Federal Reserve. And what does the Federal Reserve do? Well, they print more money. And so it's called quantitative easing. And so what our money should be worth a lot less, but there is an incentive for us and most of the rest of the world to keep the price of the US dollar stable, so that they can trade without experiencing inflation as they're trading, because you can lose money with that. And so therefore, our inflation rate is artificially low. And the only way to get a handle on this is to stop borrowing money and stop printing money. That's what you have to do. That means you have to have physical responsibility. Here's what I want to propose. We're at 34 minutes, so I've got to wrap this up. But it's time for Phil Graham's spirit to be reincarnated, and we need a balanced budget amendment. so that we can have fiscal discipline in the United States and in Congress. We need fiscal discipline, because without it, we're sunk, because economics and defense are tied together.
Well, let me add just final as we are closing out. I know, you know, that this is sort of the backlash of this massive economic sanction program that's part of integrated deterrence that I think we're going to now suffer. When you sanction these countries so much that it becomes, they become numb to it and they've prepared for it, then it becomes, it forces them to do other things. And so now we see the BRICS trying to find ways to come together and get out of trading in the American dollar. If they get, if they are successful and they find a way to break away from the American dollar as the standard currency for trade, international trade, that will be much less demand for the dollar. And if the demand for the dollar is eliminated or drastically reduced, I should say, then that will also create a lot of problems, right? Because as you said, if there's too many dollars and there's not enough people who want them or need them, then you're going to have massive inflation as well. And this will, of course, negatively affect the whole of our economy. And great powers generally don't survive when they don't have economies that can support their sovereignty, so to speak. And so I hope that we can kind of return back to the realism of let's stop threatening economic sanctions all the time, and let's re-embrace our nuclear deterrent, because when we economically sanction, we're basically hurting ourselves as well. Because our adversaries have figured that out and they're making themselves sanction proof. You know, China is the largest buyer of gold right now. They are the largest buyer of grain. They are buying massive amounts of oil and storing it. They are preparing for something, because what they feel is going to happen is when and if they ever move on Taiwan, that they know that the first weapon that the West will come at them with is economic sanctions. And so they are making themselves invulnerable to that. And so the consequence of that is that the rest of the world right now is suffering from higher prices on all of those commodities, or even food shortages, because they're buying so much just to store. And so these are real issues that don't feel like nuclear deterrence, but actually impact deterrence writ large and how nations balance each other in a realist world.
All right. Well, we'll have to end it there. We're over time. We don't want to, you know, have somebody, you know, on your drive into the Pentagon or into, you know, the SAIC building or wherever you may be, Fort Belvoir. We don't want you to have to sit in your car and to try to listen to the very last couple of minutes, or just say to heck with it, I've heard enough. So we want to go ahead and end the show, of course. So thanks, Curtis. It was a good discussion. Thanks to you, the listeners. For joining us on this episode of the NIDS View. Check us out online, thinkdeterrence.com, Global Security Review. And remember, I'm always looking for folks who want to write, because we want to publish practitioners in the field. So for those of you who listen and those of you who said, you know, I got an idea, reach out to me. You know, we'll help shape a nice article that makes a good point that people haven't thought about. All right.
Is that globalsecurityreview.com?
Yeah, globalsecurityreview.com. And check it out and read it also, because, you know, it's only successful if it's read. Now, of course, as we wrap up the show, we always want to remind you to think deterrence.
Thank you for listening to the NIDS View. This show is produced under the NIDS Podcasting Network, a division of the National Institute for Deterrence Studies. NIDS is a 501c3 organization dependent upon donations to provide this podcast and bring about awareness of the peacekeeping value of U.S. strength and our national deterrence. You can catch all of our podcasts or provide feedback at thinkdeterrence.com. I would like to thank our producer, Kimberly Charrington, our sponsors, and all the fantastic members of the National Institute for Deterrence Studies for making this podcast possible. Stay tuned next week for another exciting and informative The NIDS View.